here at the corner of Williams and Beach, we have an empty lot that used to be home to
the House of Sound. Yeah, the House of Sound record store. If you're a person that's a native Portlander, or you've ever shopped along the corridor of North Williams Avenue in the last, let's say, 50 years, or to be more specific, there was a little corner of time in there from 1960 to, let's say, the late 70s, where people in the what is historically known as the black community, and that included, you know, across different races, when it came to buying records, when it came to buying product, CDs, cassettes, well, CDs weren't out back then, there was one place that people went. This record store became the hub, an icon. You know how folks look at the barbershop as a representation where people can come and talk and speak their mind and share opinions about world, personal, and national viewpoints. Well, this was one of those places.
They didn't have an off-ramp. They didn't have the Kirby Street off-ramp to the off of the Fremont Bridge when they initially built it, but after they expanded Emmanuel Hospital, they made access to it by completing the ramp, and it changed the whole dynamics of the neighborhood because of, you know, people who would otherwise have to access it coming up from the Coliseum exit or from the north off of the Alberta exit. Well, it just changed the dynamics of the whole area. And you could see immediately the change, because there were a lot of people moving in because of the nature of the neighborhood with the rundown housing. There was some good cheap rentals over here, and that's when you saw the change, you know, really in the neighborhood, that was the precursor for what's going on now, you know. The rundown real estate to the, you know, the row houses that we're seeing now.
These guys here are the only ones that, and Charles and Woody and Paul Brown, who was part of that crew.
Yeah,
okay, I mean, those, and all the customers. Okay, which was the community that was there then, are the only ones that can really tell the story the way it was.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we talk to Mel Renfro, Clifford Walker, and others involved in the House of Sound. Stay tuned. We start tonight's show with excerpts from a 5-hour radio tribute that Eugene Rashad hosted on February 14th, 2009. We begin with David Dawson.
David Dawson.
And to your right is...
My name is Cleophas Smith. Again, back in the late 60s, early 70s, I was a product of the House of Sound.
Clee Smithy, I want to ask you a question about this. Who hired you?
Actually, David did.
Oh, David. So he was the HR department.
Well, David was one of the co-owners, along with the late, great Willie Harris.
Yeah, rest in peace.
Yeah, may he rest in peace. David and Willie were partners. David, why don't you tell the story?
Well, for a little Portland history, as you all know, our very famous Hall of Famer Mel Renfro actually started the record shop soon after signing with the Dallas Cowboys. He had Clifford Courtney Walker was running the business for him.
And my name is Clifford Walker, and I am a native Oregonian. Born, raised, schooled, played, jailed, whatever, the whole gamut of things, you know. I'm an original, and I love it. A friend of mine named Melvin Renfro, we went through high school together. He had signed a contract with the Dallas Cowboys of the National Football League, and I was coming home. There on the steps at my mother's house was Melvin. It's the first time I ever saw him in a suit. So Melvin was coming by to see me and to share his new fortune with me. He had a brand new car and a suit of clothes on, and he was coming to see his buddy. And he says, "I got a little bit of extra money. What should we do?" What do you mean, what should we do? I said, let's start a business. He said, I said, okay, what kind of business? Well, we both like music. You know, let's have a record shop. That's how it started. And he knew some other people that were kind of in the music business that worked at other record shops. And so he called them, a guy named Clarence Duke. Clarence Duke had an associate named George Page. You probably have heard that name in this town. And the four of us would meet and, you know, work out what we thought a record shop should have and be like. So, of the organization, it was like Mel was number one, you know, it was pyramid. But he was absent. He was playing football. Number two was a guy with the experience in radio and music was Clarence Duke. And he was a Lewis and Clark graduate in communication, so he was pretty sharp and pretty savvy and a little older than the rest of us, so we kind of listened to him. And then George Page, he was just a magic man. He was just on it. He knew which buttons to push and make it all come together. And then I was like the number four person. I was always looking after Melvin's interests. So after probably six or seven sets of meetings, found a location, started ordering records and selling them. We had no clue that you were supposed to have a business license or a bookkeeper or keep books. You know, we just, kids off the street, decided, you know, you go into the business, you go to the wholesaler and you sell to the people, and that's the way you did it.
So many people just worship the sign that you designed.
I probably was the person that had the most graphics training in the group. High school, a couple art classes, but I was the one that was doing that. Somebody else was playing football. Somebody else was playing in the band, you know. That kind of stuff came to me. And then you imagine House of Sounds. Well, you know, what do? You know, and records was, it wasn't tapes. It was really records. And the 45s, the LPs. So, having a little bit of music exposure. I mean, classical in the sense I know what a note looks like. It's a turn the record a little bit to the shape of the note, you know, and put a staff on it. And I think it was a quarter note. And then just we framed the house. Simple. Well, you know, it wasn't anything, you know, like, wow, but it was a concept that seemed to work. I was thinking, how many years was I actually involved? And I'm not sure. Maybe three. But Mel gave me an opportunity. He's a supporter. He supports people. And with his finances, he kind of supported his buddy who he thought had good ideas. You know, it's once in a lifetime you get that kind of deal that comes along. So I gave it my best. And, you know, you go through some changes, and after a while it was Mel and I. And Mel was out of town, so I was running it. But I didn't know anything about business. So I wouldn't say the House of Sound was so much a business when we were running it. It was more of a social community exercise, you know. People like music, and we could bring it to them. It was like a restaurant, a menu, what do you like? Try to make people happy. I was kind of like the promoter, so I was coming up with the taglines, you know. Oregon's largest selection of gospel, rhythm and blues and jazz, you know. So that's what we tried to do, keep that thing going.
Mel Renfroe, born in Houston, Texas, raised in Portland, Oregon, grade school, high school, college in Oregon, and went to play for the Dallas Cowboys in Dallas and came back during the off season to live in Portland. And I think it was maybe 1966, Cliff and I decided to open up a record store.
Melvin had made a contact with Motown that was very interesting. And when I look back, I would say the House of Sound was the Motown connection in this city.
Al Klein was one of the Motown writers, and he actually lived in Dallas. He worked in Detroit and commuted. He would send us, you know, the new releases of the Motown artists. We would put them in our store, and when they hit the radio, we would sell out. And I know many times that Cliff had to, when we didn't get them from Al Klein, place an order to an outlet in San Francisco, and they'd ship them overnight and get them to the store so we'd get them on a rack because we just couldn't keep them. It just became so popular.
You know, if I have a clear memory, we actually would underwrite a radio program.
Right.
We learned that if people heard it on the air, it was legit. And so we figured it out.
Clip, you remember the name of the show that we...
The Candyman.
Candyman.
We had so much fun with that. It was a Candyman, Candyman, oh, so sweet. I'm the Candyman. Everybody's treat. Hot mercy, baby.
You know how to find the Candyman. Just follow my sweet sugar trail.
There you go. And, you know, we had people believing we were flying into Portland just to do the show. And it created an excitement, and the people in Portland really felt special that people would fly in just to do this show. And we would just crack up and have a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
Where did they think you were flying in from?
Candyland.
Oh. We had fun with it. When we did play records, you know, people would come in to buy those records that we played. So it was really something that boosted our business and really made us very popular, because people got to where they were looking forward to it, looking forward to the show, you know, each week. So it was a fun thing.
Yeah. That's how I recollect. Once we went on the air, we reached out beyond the black community. And we found out we had a following from people other than black people that enjoyed the music. And they would come to the House of Sound to get the music. But then they would tell us they were always being stopped by the police, because the police wanted to know what white people were doing at the House of Sound. And it was an interesting story to think that your police were stopping your business. You know, that's a true story.
I remember when I was having it, of course.
Yeah.
You are listening to Circle A Radio. Tonight we are looking back at Portland history and listening to remembrances of the House of Sound, a record store that was an important part of the African-American community. The building was knocked down in 2009. Again, this is Clifford Walker.
I think that they may call Kenny, and he'll have a different take on it. He was a young man that came up from Los Angeles, and he was attending school at Pacific University. And while he was out at Pacific University, he met another one of the investors in the House of Sound, a man named Dick Daniels. And Mel and Dick were very close. They had a football component. They both played for the Cowboys, so, and went to Jeff, and that was a natural. And so Dick introduced us to Ken, and Ken was the counter boy, you know. He still thinks he landed in Nirvana when he came to Portland.
Kenny was an attorney, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, yeah. Yeah, Ken's a sharp kid. And Marine captain in Vietnam.
In 1964, I arrived in the city of Portland. I came from L.A. I'm from L.A. And walked around, you know, coming out of L.A., it was beautiful, you know, beautiful surprise. Portland has a river right down the middle of it that has water in the space where the river is, unlike L.A. So I liked everything and finally got out school in Forest Grove, which also was just beautiful trees and everything. And I met this guy named Richard Bernard Daniels, Dickie Daniels. Dickie invited me into Portland, and he had said he had some nice friends, and one of them was Mr. Clifford Courtney Walker, who happened to be the manager at that time of a record shop. The record shop happened to be owned by, you know, a local celebrity, Mel Renfro, and golly, for an 18-year-old coming out of L.A., to fall into that was just fabulous, to say the least, because, I mean, these guys were all like older brothers, lifelong friends, and certainly it was the hottest spot in Oregon at the time, because the record shop, you know, in the 60s, golly, was a focus point of the community. You know, I needed a job part-time, and I ended up with a part-time job at the hottest spot in Oregon at the time, and so that's how I got involved.
You're very kind.
Oh, you guys are kind. The thing I remember best about the House of Sound was that it was like a community resource. I mean, people would come, and while they were choosing records, they would discuss stuff that we didn't have, and they pulled our coats a lot of times. It was a gathering place, I mean, especially on the weekends. People were coming through, anybody that was having a party or some type of a gathering, they were looking for new music, they'd come. We had a lot of people who just really loved our jazz collection. We had a lot of people who loved our religious collection. Strong there, you know, between jazz, religious, music, you know, and then contemporary, I mean.
Rhythm and blues.
Four Tops, you name it. I mean, every other week somebody was coming out with something throughout all of the 60s. From the time I got there until the time I left, the word was, well, who's come out with what, or have you heard? That was probably the biggest excitement. People would come through, hey, we understand the Four Tops are so came out, the Temptations came out with something new. Have you got it? Well, no, we don't have it yet, but we'll have it. And by golly, we certainly have it within a couple of days, and boom. Then all over town, you'd hear it.
And our display,
and that was kind of nice, too.
The display was, the way we had it fit, was pegboard.
Once again, that was Mr. Walker's genius. This guy,
I don't know.
Next to us.
You're funny, man. We would have 100 records on the wall, 45s, just lined up, and the title. If I start visualizing, you're right. You had Marvin Gaye, and you had Ray Charles, and you had Eddie James, and Johnny Taylor, and, oh, man, Solomon Burke.
We even broke some backsides. With,
you know, the 45s were driving it. The albums, you know, they cost a little more money, $3.98 or something. And for 98 cents, you could get a 45. I remember I was talking with a colleague, a businessman, and I went up to him and I said, Paul, this girl came up, and she had 98 pennies in her hand, and she wanted to buy this record. And this girl had been coming into the record shop, I don't know how many times, say, Mister, would you please play that record? I get it, play it, you know. That's where people came in to hear the music. And she kept doing that. And after maybe 2 months, she had 98 pennies in her hand. This is a true story. So she put it out there. And she could hardly reach over the counter. You know, she must have been 10 years old. And something in me told me I wasn't a businessman. I couldn't take the money. Shit, I knew what it was to her. And, you know, being a big shot, House of Sound. Hey, this one's on the House of Sound. You know, this girl, you know, she was happy. And she took off. And I was just out of the service and, you know, pretty straight guy then. And a couple hours later, she comes back. And she's trying to hand me something. Finally catches my attention. This girl handed me a joint. That was her way of saying thank you. And I was deaf on marijuana at the time. You know, it was crazy. But she converted me because it was a gift. And it just kind of, wow. Well, you know, this girl, this is the way she knows how to say thank you. I don't know what environment she's coming from, but she thought the man at the House of Sound would like a joint, you know. So, okay. And I went to a guy and I said, does it ever hurt you to take money from people? You really, you know, they don't need to be spending it on, you know, luxury like a record. And he said, no, you don't need to be in business. We were just having a party. That's what it was. It was a party for 2 or 3 years. We lived in a wonderful world.
Yeah, and that's what it was. I mean, the focus was music.
It was great, you know. You had just Motown and Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye, Martha and the Vandellas, the Temptations, the Four Tops, Junior Walker. Who else? You know, it was pre-Jackson 5. Aretha Franklin, Sam and Dave, Rufus Thomas.
There's always lots of different things you can do in life. But when you're handing out joy, you know, it's a joyous thing. I don't think it was anything that took away from awareness. It just alleviated boredom. And it gave a lift because, like the jazz, a lot of the jazz stuff we had was down to the bone.
It was a different era.
They were entertaining. And the heck with it.
You know,
it was a different age at that time. You know, certainly the community had a lot of problems, but then it also had some joys. And one of the joys was the music and being able to entertain each other and get home and actually if you think about all that music, it's classic stuff. The lyrics and the melodies still cross through our culture in lots of ways.
Not only was it an entertainment center, but it was shelter, because there weren't many places an African-American person could actually go into a business and kind of hang around. It was no threat. If you were to go in Fred Meyer's and hang around or any place else, the police would be on you. So it was a place where people could actually have a legitimate excuse to meet in a public place and not cause any fear. The music was a mix. Yeah, I met a lot of beautiful people from all racial groups. It was good. There were challenges. I mean, when Mel left Portland, and you talk about the politics, he went to Dallas, Texas. And Dallas, Texas in the early 60s, they were still a very segregated place.
Yeah. And I ran into a lot of static and things that never experienced in Portland or in Oregon. And I had to learn to deal with it. And I know my dad told me real early in life, after we came out of the South, that there, you know, some things you can do and some things you can't do, and you have to be careful where you go. I realized that when I got there.
One of my favorite stories is not so much about the House of Sounds or even Mel sharing a celebrity with us as a football player. But while Mel was in Dallas, he took on the challenge of opening up housing in Dallas. He had the courage and dignity to say that he felt he was entitled to live in a decent place. And he actually went to court and fought and won to get a place to live in Dallas, Texas, in spite of the fact he was a star player on the America's team. There was another reality in life, and I always will salute Mel for putting that risk so much just to do the right thing.
Yeah, and it actually changed the civil rights law in Dallas. They were denying housing to people of color, and they changed that law because of my lawsuit.
All right, man, I salute you. But this is fun, yeah. It's not something I think about much. And it gives you a chance to reflect. And I was up at the Veterans Hospital, and there was a guy named Marshall. And he said to me, he's working up there, and he sees me, and he's always got a big smile on his face. And he says, I got my first check from you guys. Marshall Richmond, he was saying. So that was another thing. We got a chance to actually be employers.
Yeah, that was another thing that you hit the nail on the head, Cliff. We put people to work in the neighborhood, and I know that was appreciated because, back in those days, it was just a little bit tougher sometimes for people to find work.
Well, I'd tell the story that if you weren't a heavily recruited ball player like yourself, Mel, there wasn't a whole lot for the rest of us to do but join the service or hope we could get a job at the Benson Hotel if you were lucky.
If you had a student loan, you might be able to go to college.
Yeah, right.
Those were the only options.
When you go back and you reflect, it was probably, Ken, I was saying it was probably one of the few businesses in town where black people could go through the doors and hang out and congregate and not be a threat to anybody.
It was all positive. There were no detriments in coming, because if nothing else in your life, if you find a record or some music that you can sit back and enjoy. You're not in the streets. You're not out hurting somebody else. The records didn't cost an inordinate amount. It didn't break anybody. And, of course, a lot of people just came around to listen. Ambiance of being around the place where people come and everybody's in a good mood, and when they leave, they're in a good mood.
Well, I just want to say one thing, and I don't want to embarrass you, Cliff, but this would not have happened if it hadn't been for Clifford Walker. And he was the backbone, and he was the guy that was there at night, and sometimes he slept there many nights. He kept it going, and I just got to say, man, I love you, and thanks for the memories.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Renfro. Thank you so much, man.
That was Mill Renfro and Clifford Walker. You are listening to Circulate Radio on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Tonight, we are listening to remembrances from former staff and owners of the House of Sound Record Store, which was an important business for the African American community in Portland. Mel Renfro, the first owner, now talks about selling the business to Willie Harris.
But Willie Harris had he owned the building, and he had his barbershop on the corner, and we were in the middle, I believe, and he had his little grocery store on the other side. Willie, right next door, we called him the mayor of North Portland.
Uh-huh. It's like a
hub, a little
yeah,
hub.
Yeah, the Black Grand Central Station.
Right, right. And it was fun. And I actually sold the House of Sound to Willie.
Okay.
Willie Harris.
After 2 years or so, Melvin Renfro decided to sell the record shop to Willie Harris and I. I left in probably 75 or so. At that point, Willie took over the full operation with the help of his nephew, who pretty much ran it, and the hired help that he would hire, you know, to oversee the operation, because he continued to cut hair in the barbershop next door to it.
We did the inventory. We got set on a price, and we agreed upon it, and we just turned the keys over to him.
It was a pretty smooth transition because the generations, you know, they were all neighborhood kids and brothers, and it would have been seamless.
Yeah, we all went to school together and grew up together.
And we were all hanging out at the shop.
Yeah, we were all neighbors. So, and I think, Cliff, you were moving on to something else. So you.
Well, I probably hit the wall, you know. I mean.
Yeah, and I think maybe you started going to school.
I did, yeah. And it's an honor to think that that tradition carried so long.
Yeah, well, we passed the baton.
We bought her from Melvin Renfro on a contract. He carried a contract for us, and we actually purchased the record shop at that point. Then acquired some property next door to where it was at that point, and then we remodeled an old building and moved into it and had the barbershop with Willie on one side, and the record shop was in the middle. And pretty much we're in that location until... After I left, they moved it back over into the corner building, the old Brooks grocery store site.
Wow, so this was like almost a one-stop, cutting heads and listening to cuts.
And telling lies.
Yes, Willie was known to be a great philosopher, as everyone knows out there.
I don't think there was really any change in the philosophy. Willie was a little bit more...
He knew how to count.
Oh, well, yeah, Willie.
I didn't know how to count.
In Oregon,
I knew how to party. Didn't know how to count.
Calvin Harris, one of the top businessmen in Oregon.
This had nothing to do with the record store, but it'll just give you an idea of the atmosphere. Willie was a kind of barber where, you know, I would come in and I'd sit down in the chair and I'd say, I want you to take a little off of here and a little off there. And he'd say, do I come down there to the University of Oregon and tell you how to write your papers? And I'd start laughing, and I'd say, no. He said, well, I'm the barber. I'm going to cut your hair the way that I want it. And, I mean, we would just laugh, and that would carry over into the record store.
But if you think about it, Willie Harris was cutting hair. At about $6 a head, it was labor-intensive capital, you know, and what he did was he took that labor-intensive capital job, a business profession, and he turned it into real estate investments, which was really genius.
Well, he's kind of like the black preacher, you know. He had his congregation, and he had his own cash flow. Politics wasn't going to get in in the way of it. You know, people would support him, and people would like.
Willie was a strong guy. Probably in his direction of the record shop. I think he kept it going, and he actually it prospered with him.
Right.
He ended up buying the whole building because I think both of you guys were renters at the time for Mr. Brooks, right?
Right, right.
He had the foresight to buy it. He bought everything in sight. And, you know, he had to do it by strictly making deposits, not goofing the money off. He didn't drink. I don't even think he smoked cigarettes or anything.
He worked hard.
He worked hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, unfortunately, it killed him.
Willie was focused in a way that I don't think many of us were at the time. I suspect Mr. Brooksy, or the guy that had the property, and I don't know this to be true, but took Willie under his arms or his wing and helped him get established and get the building. And even in high school, Mr. Brooksy had a store, a grocery store, and Willie and a couple of guys were fortunate enough to work for Mr. Brooksy in the store.
He was a very responsible guy, yeah.
You know, so we were lucky. You know, there, I worked for a guy named Dillard Hudson. He was in the black beauty products business.
Right.
People don't know. There is an edge, but there's not a lot of role models. And we were fortunate enough to see a couple really excellent black business role models.
Some of the best. Dillard had been a porter on the chain. Porter was one of the top jobs.
Yeah, right, right. It was Americana at its best. had that black service on the railroads, you know, make you believe in the what do you call it, the tooth fairy. I mean, I worked on the railroads, you know. People put the shoes out at night, they wake up in the morning, they're all shiny. This is amazing.
but he did it without being obsequious.
No, I ran his beauty products for him, so, you know, I was lucky.
The House of Sound. Now, for those of you who may not, you may remember the House of Sound or you may not. The physical location geographically was where now?
3606 Williams Avenue, just south of Beach.
This was a remarkable landmark space where people came and purchased records. And during that time, there was so much music going on. The Motown sound was had heated up, and we're moving into some R&B and some soul. What were some of the groups that were really, really burning?
Well, I have a favorite. The Whispers, I would say, were my favorite. Yes, we pushed a lot of Motown because they were the ones that got the radio play. And the other music we specialized in was primarily because it didn't get the radio play in this market up here. In Oregon, in Washington, we were really deprived of you know, the latest in the R&B. So we had to seek out, you know, other sources for it. And I had a very good distributor down in the Bay Area who would keep us on top of, you know, what was new. And we would, in fact, just play it loud and clear in the record shop, and it sold itself.
Wow. Juan.
Yes.
You hear these griot?
Yes.
What you got for us, brother?
What do I have? My mother, we were here in 1980, and we would listen to KBOO, and Mom's was a music fiend. She would go to House of Sound. I was just on the phone with her, and I said, "Mom, the brothers from House of Sound, they're here." When I was 8 years old, she got me into all of the music that I listen to now. Hmm. We're talking 28 years later, there was a nice patch where I would say, "Why does she keep playing that Nancy Wilson? Oh, that Dee Dee Sharp and that Stanley Turrentine. Oh, please, you're playing it too much." And then that's all I play now. And that's all my children listen to right now. So
House of Sound was impactful for me in my childhood and the development of me appreciating music and appreciating our culture. So
we're trying to connect the dots here, and I'm
connecting them.
I'm saying that your mother also has a significant milestone in that she was one of the dancers on Soul Train.
Oh yeah, Soul Train. She's best to talk about. All I can do is really talk about my experience in the front row. When I was sitting in the front row, I was concerned about the Kentucky Fried Chicken and the tab soda that would be in the big trash cans. They'd have these big trash cans full of tab soda and buckets of KFC. So I would wait for the producer to say, all right, cut, break, and then bring the chicken and the soda in there. In between that time, moms would say, son, this is Don Cornelius. How you doing, Mr. Cornelius? Son, this is Smokey Robinson right here. How you doing, Mr. Robinson? I'm just caring about the chicken. You know, I Bootsy Collins and Parliament Funkadelic Al Green, they just folks. You know, I'm just trying to eat this chicken. That was it. That was one of the main memories for me. And then when I reflect back in my times of performing on stage, I think it was those handshakes and those hugs and that interaction from those brothers that passed on something to me that... You see how that works?
Yes, I do.
You see how that works?
Yes, sir.
It was amazing, and I'm very humbled and honored to be here meeting you for the second time, Brother Cleek. And
right on, Juan.
Seeing Brother David, I'm excited. That's all I can say. I'm just excited to be here.
Who we got on the mic, Cleek Smitty?
Well, we got a special guest that just stepped in.
He's
late as normal. But everybody knows him as Woodrow. I knew him as Lil Woody.
When I look at your face, Woody, you know what comes to my mind? The House of Sound. Out of all the faces, your face, you probably sold me my George Benson Beyond the Blue Horizon, because that's right off of First Light when George was doing all them freaky guitar notes. He said, get this one. You sold me, I'm sure, my Red Clay album, the CTI album. You remember all that stuff. Now, you sold a lot of records.
Oh, yeah.
You a vinyl factory.
Yeah, I go way back. Yeah, I came there. It wasn't for my brother, David, and Willie. You know, Willie's just like my uncle. Well, he's just like my brother. Not uncle. He's like my brother, too. And Cleo was like my brother, too, you know. Mm-hmm. Timmy, Chucky, and Billy, which talked about on radio. Everybody nice, you know. We had fun. We had a good times. I hardly see no bad times, you know. That was so great in those days, you know.
Well, I got to ask you a question. I'm going to be greedy here and take some liberties here. Was a diamond really in the back? Was it really a sunroof top?
Man,
that was... But it really digging it seemed, but a gay only. That's what I'm trying to ask you.
It wasn't Curtis Mayfield either. It wasn't Curtis Mayfield. What they used to say, Curtis Mayfield. William D. Farr had to get it straight.
That's right.
True story. Everybody used to say, man, give me that record by Curtis Mayfield. I said, nah, man, this is William D. Farr. You know, William D. Farr, you know.
Woody, yeah. I got to ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
When you gave that cut out, or was it a 45?
Yes, it was.
Did you feel like you were extending... culture to people, or just another record?
Both. You know, it was just such a mellow song. You remember that, like, Smokey Robinson grooving on a Sunday afternoon, and everybody used to go up, which we call it leaning. You know, used to go Williams Avenue, Martin Luther King, come down Alberta, go all the way to Knott, and come all the way around. You know, that's the kind of feeling I had. Everybody's leaning. You know, called the lean.
This is the House of Sound Revisited. We got three of the pillars from that historic, iconoclastic building that's now history. The physical building is gone.
Right.
But the wings remain.
Oh, yeah.
True story. True story.
Woody, you here, man?
Yes.
Damn it.
True. You know, it's always going to be a memory to go way back, you know. I trying to remember when I first started. You know,
oh, you just, can't, man, you can't remember that. Really? You were born there. You can't remember that.
But I remember, you know, we used to come, me and a couple friends, we, you know, had the first 45.
The electronic toys we play with nowadays are nothing like they were then, because I can remember the first four-track tape player, M-U-N-T-Z.
Right. Yep.
And at that time, there was a stereo shop around on what is now Martin Luther King Boulevard. It was the stereo something, but it was a wholesale house. We used to go around there. We actually installed stereos in cars, stereos and the speaker systems, and that was another way of making a sale. At the time, I had a Volkswagen, and it was wired for sound. I mean, it had speakers that you could only go half volume and live through it, you know. In trying to pedal these stereo units, I would find out what kind of music somebody likes and then take them for a ride in the Volkswagen, and it was sold by the time you got them back, you know. And I never will forget this. He was a little bit older than I was, but I hemmed him up in that Volkswagen and had Aretha Franklin's Respect playing on there, and I changed the man, I'm sure. Ronald Stevens, if you're out there listening, you know who I'm talking about. But Aretha Franklin on four-track tape of Respect, and I mean, it was kicking, man. It was kicking.
Now, what about the statute of limitations? We can talk about it now.
We also did a little custom tape recording back in those days, because like I say, we couldn't go to a store and buy the music we wanted, so we had to create. So we would, and if you know the music industry, they have a way of putting a couple of songs on an album to get you to buy it, but the rest of it would just be filler stuff. So we alleviated that problem by making these custom tapes.
Pray tell.
Yeah, and by today's standards, it was probably criminal, and if you're listening out there, I'm hoping the statute of limitations is up. But we made a lot of people happy with our music, our custom.
A lot of people.
Yeah. Somebody would come in and say, you know, we're going on a trip to San Francisco, and I'd give them enough music to get them there without listening to the same thing twice.
And someone might come in and say, hey, I'm meeting a new lady tonight. We're going to ride around on town. Hook me up with some nice, smooth music. And we do that. You know, we throw some Dells on, some OJs, Manhattans.
Now, what were the hours on a Saturday, a typical Saturday? 11, you guys open at 11?
Oh, yeah. We probably opened 10, 11, and we closed when the last person came in.
So they had to come in at least by 10 to have it at the end of the day.
It depends. You know, the pimps might throw us a couple extra dollars, and we'd have theirs hooked up in an hour. See?
Yeah, it was real time recording.
It was real time.
You know,
in the summertime, might be open a little bit later too. You know, when the weather was nice,
warm summer nights.
Warm summer.
A little bit later.
Yeah,
and customarily, we close up. It might be 10, 11 o'clock. David and I would jump in his BMW, 1969, 2002 BMW. We'd pick us up a couple bottles of Pinot Chardonnay, lean, put some music in the 8-track, and just roll. Those were the days.
You are listening to Circle A Radio. Tonight we hear about the House of Sound from community members and former employees and customers. This is Eugene Rashad from a radio tribute recorded on February 14th, 2009.
Juan, yes. Introduce your mom. She's on the air.
Come on, Juan, get it out.
Introduce my mother. My mother introduced me. How am I supposed to be able to introduce her? This is an impossible thing. This is my love. This is my life giver, life bearer, and if I got out of line, the life taker. I just love her. What else do I need to say? Mama, I love you.
You are my love.
And I have a question for you, because you know I'm nosy.
Yes, sir.
You know how our friendship, Juan's, and our friendship goes. It's abiding, it's deep, it's schizophrenic, it's seasonal, it's cyclical, right? Okay.
Right. Yeah.
But during some of that weather, he says something to me about a piece of your history. People know about the television program Soul Train.
Right.
And it's legendary. And Don Cornelius had those people just shaking their fannies in on national television. But there was some very, very creative dance styles going on, and you were among those purveyors because you were there.
Exactly.
This is an historic moment. Will you please share with us what that was like, experiencing that sweat, that atmosphere, that humidity on that show?
Wow. Soul Train. See, the first thing, the history, it was exciting because of just the relationship of the beauty involved with it, the commercials. I was first like a serious fan. So when I saw the people saying Watu Wazuri, beautiful people, use Afro Sheen, those commercials with the people that look like me and look like my brothers and sisters, that was a wonderful thing. So when I went there, it really was to audition for a singing group they were starting. Once I started dancing on there and seeing these acts that I had grown up watching and and dancing with brothers and sisters from different kinds of schools, I was one of the only parents there, at least one of the only ones who told that they had a child. And it went from me trying to act like nonchalant, like this is really no big deal, to becoming so consumed with being there for each taping and having my son sit there where he can see Smokey Robinson, where he can meet him during a break. And those things are, you know what, I really didn't quite understand how great those things were until just a few months ago when my son made a videotape.
The video, the video montage that I uploaded on YouTube.
He started writing me and talking about that time, and I still had to reconcile being a part of the 60s and a part of the movement and then thinking that my being on a television show seemed sort of frivolous after a while. I had issues that I had to work out, and then when I started really realizing, like, that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
It was just fun, and I enjoyed having fun, and we taped about four shows on the weekends, and most of us didn't watch them because we were partying when the shows were on. The dances that we did were fun. They were hard to do when you were on the risers, and often I was on the risers. When I was on the floor, I really got down. I really would dance hard.
Wow. Wow.
And then they started the record company, and I started promoting records for Soul Train Records just within a month of being on the show.
Mm-hmm. Well, I need to ask you this question. I didn't think that it was possible for a record store in Portland to capture a piece of that history. But clearly, the House of Sound, in fact, was a chaser of history, and it captured a lot of what was going on Soul Train. And I thought it was a great representation of the movement and the sensibility of Black Americans during that time. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Right. See, when I got here, because of all the records I had when I was in L.A., I thought I'll never need any more records. But it turned out that I moved in such a quick manner, I didn't get to bring my music with me. So a brother that I knew named Vance Madlock, who had played with some of the Funk Brothers in Detroit, told me to go to House of Sound. And he said, whatever records you didn't have, you can get there.
Wow.
Right. And so that's where I went. And I met I met a number of people there that were so nice and so respectful and kind in there. And I started buying my music from there. And one of the albums that I saw that they had sort of featured for a while, I had helped promote and had done some of the artwork for a graphic company, and they had given me free 500 albums because of my involvement with the company. And so I said something to one of the brothers there. Before I know it, I'm buying an album. And I had enough. I never need another one of those. Now, all the other albums I needed. But they said, good salespeople, I'm buying an album. I go back and tell Vance. And they were nice, but before I knew it, and I pulled out of the bag what I bought, he was just cracking up. He said, that's the last album you needed, huh? And I said, but they were so nice in their salesmanship and their kindness they were. They sold me this album, and I was on the cover.
Wow.
It was nice, the experiences I would have. Then a couple of years later, I gave a fashion show, and they allowed me to have some tickets be left there.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Right, and the people would pick the albums up. I mean,
the tickets up.
Remember, son?
Right, I do.
On the Rocks downtown, and they said leave. And Gene Page actually suggested that.
Wow.
So, right. It was a fun time. I really didn't know there were any other record stores in Oregon that time. I was here from 78 to 80. My son and I then lived just 2 years here. That was it to me. House of Sound was it.
That was it.
Yeah.
That was it.
Wow.
I don't wanna do wrong, but you've been gone away so long.
The biggest shocker was traveling down Williams Avenue and looking over on the east side of the street and seeing nothing but a big hole in the ground. So it's gone, but it'll always be remembered.
But it's changed. I mean, nobody can, you can't stop it. So I guess we're left to adjust to it, or...
Woody, Timmy, Brother Dawson, Cleet, the real Fantastic Four, Justice League Elite, Super Hebros, slinging high hopes on wax, Regal Griots, identity tagging, paper bagging 33s, 45s, even those bootleg 8-tracks. Shh. Gangsta leaning down the north side, ragtop slick vines to the nine, just left the shop with a Quo Vadis crop. Spirit breathing, digging the scene, and I ain't leaving. Flipping a master blaster page, local colors the rage, literally. Young today don't know the tradition, so we hope those loose for change better listen with conviction. Respect the flavorhood like Bobby Blue. This time I'm gone to get me a cut. Buy me a cut, and later tonight, get me some cut if I'm good to go. Whether you rock the limp or rode holy with a Bible in tow, Woody would know. Package your needs, tailor your taste, just Brother Dawson would adjust to your wants by checking your face. Is Woody in? Yes, sir. What's going on, brother? What do you recommend? Hey, it's in the bag, man. We just got it in. $3.99, brother. Just thank you, please come again. Word on the street was that Woody don't miss a beat. He don't want to do wrong. Just want to unify the community in song. 3606 will mix you a tape, send you on your merry way. Hop in the Beamer, throw back some Chardonnay. Made a profit by being a prophet, ain't that a day? An expression outlet. Love supreme, they had a dream before Union Ave became king from the outset. We're giving honor to the brothers, plus Willie, Charles, Billy Holt. Still strong, it may be over, but they ain't out yet. Pour a little liquid for the temple that ain't here. Pop the Pinot Noir, then au revoir, that's French for bye. The best of brotherhood, selling your soul in a beauty wood. The House of Sound will never die.
Yeah. The House of Sounds Revisited.
Thank you, thank you. It's good to know there's listeners out here.
What a remarkable moment in the history of this program and in general the history of KABU that's given us an opportunity to connect the dots. What a wonderful experience. What great voices moving across the tapestry of sound. Hitting all the notes, hitting all the keys, and singing in perfect harmony. What a wonderful evening. What a wonderful afternoon. We hope that you, the listener, have a level of appreciation and a better understanding of what lies beneath the layer of gentrification.
It's what?
It's mind-boggling, you know? I guess change benefits some, but not everyone.
Thanks to those interviewed about the House of Sound and its vibrant history as a community and cultural space, Clifford Walker, Mel Renfro, Ken Dixon, David Dawson, Eugene Rashad, Cleo Smith, Billy Holt, Woodrow Wilson Jr., Keita Gianetti, and Juan. And special thanks to those who helped make all this possible, including Vanessa Rennick and Charles Bedford. You have been listening to Circulate Radio. We can be heard the first and third Wednesdays at 6 p.m. here on your member-owned community radio station, KBOO Portland. You can contact us through the KBOO website at kboo.fm/circulateradio or at circlearadio@gmail.com. Our next show airs March 17th. Thanks for listening.